From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Just 2 days after Super Tuesday, Mitt Romney is leaving the Republican presidential race. Here to tell us what this means is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So we have spoken many times, and on Tuesday, Romney vowed to keep on fighting, even though he didn't do that well on Super Tuesday. So what changed?
I think what changed was they sat down and they did the numbers. They did the math. And there is no sense whatsoever in remaining in this race if you're Mitt Romney. Among other things, they did not really know on Tuesday night just how much difference there was going to be between John McCain and Mitt Romney when all the delegate allocations had been calculated. Now that that's been done, John McCain is more than halfway to having the 1,191 he needs to be nominated. He has well over double the number that Mitt Romney has. So when we look at the events that are still on the calendar, John McCain would have to almost literally stop winning any delegates at all in the remaining contests, and Mitt Romney would need to take 80% of all the delegates from here on out. That's just not possible. Mathematically, it just doesn't work out. He has essentially been all but eliminated. And today, he's saying that he's tired of spending $5 or $10 million of his own money every week to get beat.
Now, Romney has sometimes been criticized by party members for not being conservative enough and for changing his position on social issues. Here is part of his speech today.
The attack on faith and religion is no less relentless. And tolerance for pornography, even celebration of it, and sexual promiscuity, combined with the twisted incentives of government welfare, have led to today's grim realities. 68% of African-American kids born out of wedlock, 45% of Hispanic kids, 25% of white kids. How much harder it is for these kids to succeed in school and in life. A nation built on the principles of the founding fathers cannot long stand when its children are raised without fathers in the home.
So ultimately, how did Romney stand on issues including poverty and race?
I think Mitt Romney's positions throughout 2007 and the first month of 2008 have been as conservative as the speech that he has been giving for the last half hour at the Conservative Political Action Conference here in Washington, D.C., which he has chosen to make the occasion of his departure from the contest. He was as anti-choice on abortion as anyone could ever be. He was as in favor of tax cuts as anyone could ever be. He was as against any kind of civil unions or gay marriage as anyone could be. Now, in some respects, these new positions were reversals of where he stood when he was either governor of Massachusetts earlier in this decade or when he was running for the Senate from Massachusetts back in 1994. But of course, he was now seeking a national Republican position as opposed to a Massachusetts position. And so he made some major changes. That was the source of suspicion on the part of many people on the right. They thought, well, Mitt's with us now, but he hasn't always been. Maybe when he gets to the White House, he'll change again.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for giving us an update on the race.
My pleasure, Farai.
That was NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. And now, as the presidential race tightens even more, we turn to one of the specific issues the candidates are putting front and center. We're talking about the economy. With a shrinking job market and rising home foreclosures, Americans have less money and more problems. Of course, the top candidates say they've got the cure for what ails our bank accounts. But who's got the money plan that's best or worst for poor and working class Americans and for African Americans? Joining me now to sort through proposals by the presidential hopefuls in both parties is economist Thomas Pally. He heads the Economics for Democratic and Open Societies Project in Washington, D.C. Thomas, welcome to News and Notes.
Hello, Farai.
So let's start with the economic stimulus. The president has proposed a multi-billion dollar plan to jumpstart the economy. You also have the House okaying that plan and the Senate working on their own plan. How are the three leading Republican candidates addressing the basic issues of the stimulus?
The basic position of the Republicans is to focus on tax cuts. They've all come behind and endorsed the Bush package, and some have gone further for bigger, more permanent tax cuts. Huckabee has thrown in a little bit more of sort of personal tax cuts, but that's a statement of their approach to the economy. In my view, it's really not the best approach. There's very little evidence that these tax cuts stimulate growth, and to the extent that they do, they take quite a long while to kick in.
What about the whole term trickle-down economics that came into vogue during the 1980s? What exactly is trickle-down economics, which you seem to be criticizing, and is this another version of it?
Indeed, this is very much a continuation of the trickle-down paradigm that we've been living with for 25 years. The idea there is that if you cut taxes on rich folk and if you cut taxes on business, they will then go out and create economic opportunity that will then trickle down and benefit those at the bottom of the economic pyramid, as it were. And I think unambiguously, trickle down does not work. We've had 25 years of the experiment. Growth has not accelerated, inequality has gotten worse, and now we're stuck on the precipice of a recession that could be quite severe.
But let me press you on this. It has not been 25 years of unbroken Republican rule. Certainly you had President Bill Clinton. Was he part of the same structure, essentially, of looking at how government relates to finance? How was he the same or different from what you're talking about?
The essential paradigm was established in the early 1980s through Ronald Reagan, and the economic policy paradigm has been very much a Republican one. Bill Clinton broke with little bits of it, but by and large, he sort of governed within the framework that was established by Republicans.
So Governor Huckabee has something that he's pushing called a fair tax. What is that?
Well, Governor Huckabee wants to move towards a consumption tax and get rid of the income tax. It's great populist rhetoric, of course, of getting rid of the Internal Revenue Service, but that isn't going to happen. We have so many important functions that government does for us. We rely on government in so many ways that we don't appreciate that it's inconceivable that we could fund this through a consumption tax in that way. And then on top of that, in general, these type of consumption tax proposals tend to be very regressive and tend to hit poorer people more. And there's a very simple reason for that. Poorer people tend to spend 100% of their income and therefore tend to have to pay a lot of consumption tax. Richer folk don't do that and therefore get taxed less.
Let's move over to the Democratic side. You've got Senator Barack Obama with a $75 billion plan that involves tax rebates, pouring money into unemployment insurance and housing crisis relief. What are the basics of his approach?
Well, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton sort of share, it looks to me like a fairly similar economic outlook. They do focus on getting money into the economy quickly, getting it to people that will spend the money, and therefore having a lot of bang for buck, which is exactly the type of policy you need to deal with a recession. Unemployment insurance is extending unemployment insurance, lengthening the duration, is a particularly good tool because it gets to people who need it, and that's wonderful. And then, of course, those people spend it right away. On top of that, Barack Obama came out with a much more sensible tax plan in the sense that, low-income rebates, again, getting it to people who will spend it. Hillary Clinton was a little bit slower on that, and she came out and joined him after that. But the strong point about Hillary Clinton's program was that she also emphasizes government spending and using a recession, turning a recession into an opportunity. She says, look, we've got to do some investment on sort of global warming issues, energy independence issues. Let's use the recession to start creating a green economy.
Now, when you look at someone who is no longer in the race, John Edwards, he was often portrayed by his supporters and portrayed himself as someone who was going to make ending poverty the center of his campaign. How would his approach have differed from both Senators Obama and Clinton?
Well, actually, it turns out at the end of the day, the Edwards approach is fairly similar to sort of a combination of the Clinton and Obama proposals. And that's not surprising because John Edwards was the person who came out with a plan first. I thought it was the best plan. And the other candidates, as they did on a lot of issues, actually copied John Edwards. In fact, John Edwards has truly been a forcing figure during this election, compelling Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both to be more progressive than they might otherwise have been.
Well, let's talk a little bit about political philosophy. We've talked a bit about trickle-down economics, but then there's also the model of the government getting directly involved, certainly ending the Great Depression by creating jobs itself, everything from jobs for writers and artists to road building, infrastructure. That does not seem to be a model that's been followed, certainly not to that extent, in decades. Is that even on the table, the whole prospect of the government actually stepping in and doing job creation itself?
This really is the crux of the philosophical difference between Republicans and Democrats on this recession issue, and actually on a broader set of issues. The Republicans always say, just cut taxes, trickle down, and that'll solve it. The Democrats have a much more varied policy approach that includes public spending, includes targeted tax cuts, and more generally, they see a well-functioning economy as needing some sort of umpire and arbiter that regulates the economy to see that all get a fair shake.
Well, Mr. Pally, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
I've been speaking with economist Thomas Pally. He heads the Economics for Democratic and Open Societies Project. The Washington-based project focuses on public education about economic issues. And Pally is also the author of Plenty of Nothing, The Downsizing of the American Dream.
Just ahead, black folks have won just about every movie award in the book, including Oscars. But are we still shucking and jiving our way onto the big screen? We'll talk about black stereotypes in film and the Super Bowl and Super Trades on our Sports Bloggers Roundtable. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes.
I present the Academy Award for the best performance of an actress in supporting roles during 1939 to Hattie McDaniel.
Hattie McDaniel broke ground as the first African-American performer to win an Oscar.
Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science, fellow members of the motion picture industry, and honored guests, this is one of the happiest moments of my life. I sincerely hope I shall always be a credit to my race and to the motion picture industry. My heart is too full to tell you just how I feel. And may I say thank you and God bless you.
She won the statue for playing Mammy in Gone with the Wind. That's a role a lot of people, both now and then, thought of as a stereotype. We continue our series on African Americans in film today with a look at stereotypes, how they've played out historically and how they've evolved over the years. Anna Everett is a professor and chair of film and media studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She's here to help us unpack some of this cultural baggage. Anna, welcome.
Thank you, Farai.
So, Anna, let's hear a little bit of Hattie McDaniel as Mammy when Scarlett O'Hara asks her a question.
What trouble are you talking about?
You know what trouble I was talking about. I was talking about Mr. Asa Wilkes. He'll be coming to Atlanta when he gets his leave, and you're sitting there waiting for him just like a spider. He belongs to Miss Melanie.
You go pack my things like Mother said.
Now, Anna, was this the only kind of role that 1930s Hollywood could even envision rewarding a black woman for playing?
I think that's about right to say, because this was one of the familiar roles that African Americans were cast in, and Hattie McDaniels actually did the role with such aplomb and such facility that I think there are a couple of issues that surround McDaniels' performance in the first place. I mean, number one is that she was clearly excellent at the delivery of the lines and inhabiting the persona. But on the other hand, there was concern about the limitations on her talents. And so she clearly made the best of what was available for her at the time. And the second issue is the black press, as you may be aware, Farai, had a campaign against stereotypes in films because they recognized what we call the documentary effect of fiction films. And what that means is that even though we know that films and these films were fictionalized tales or treatments, if you don't have direct exposure or experiences with someone, those representations have a reality effect for you, so you tend to believe them. So the problem for the black press was twofold. On the one hand, they delighted in her performances, but they recoiled at the stereotypes that were, certainly confounding the new Negro idea that black people had of themselves at this time.
Let's talk a little bit about gender, because there's one set of stereotypes that often go with female characters, and then there's men. And this is in the present movie era. I want to play a clip from Michael Clark Duncan's performance as John Coffey, a condemned prisoner in the Green Mile. Now, Coffey, a death row inmate, is explaining to Tom Hanks' prison guard character why he wants his life not to be spared.
I'm tired, boss. Tired of being on the road, lonely as a sparrow in the rain. I'm tired of never having me a buddy to be with, to tell me where we's going to, coming from, or why.
Now, Michael Clark Duncan won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for that role. His Oscar came 60 years after Hattie McDaniel got hers. So was his role a stereotype as well?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think there are differences in the levels of stereotypes, as you pointed out, in terms of gender. And in the case of Michael Clark Duncan, I mean, he clearly does inhabit that that trajectory that Donald Bogle kind of identifies as, you know, toms, coons, mammies, bucks, and mulattoes, this limited range of roles that are available. And so clearly Michael Clark Duncan's character recalls somewhat the Gus character in Birth of a Nation. I know we're not going to discuss it, but it's this archetype of, you know, of the giant, you know, the menacing black male brute. But Duncan's character kind of refines that a bit. He's this gentle giant, but he's a simpleton. You know, he's infantilized. But the interesting thing, too, about his character is that he's decontextualized from any kind of black family. So he's this singular black figure, which is, you know, kind of normal for these stereotypes. And he finds his value in servicing and helping white society and culture. And he's misunderstood in his efforts to do well, or as he says in the film, I just want to help, you know. And so when his help is met with this resistance and incarceration and ultimately, you know, death, you can see him anticipating that. And the idea is that it's better to die than to inhabit this black body.
Well, when you mention that, I mean, is there a certain fatalism that underlies these stereotypes? I mean, is it really a situation? You talk about the documentary effect, what you call the documentary effect, where we take fiction in as reality, at least emotional reality. Is there a fatalism in these depictions of black life through stereotypes?
That's really an interesting question, and I want to respond in this way. There are two approaches. And some of the research that I've done and black people's relationships to stereotypes are, to black stereotypes in particular, are often quite different from black reactions. And what I had read in the black press about the time of, let's say, Gone with the Wind, was that, you know, black people would go to these movies and really enjoy aspects of them because they didn't recognize these as true representations of themselves. So they were comedies to them. They could laugh, you know, at the representations, right? Whereas for whites who would see like a similar film, there would be this kind of different relationship, again, this kind of documentary effect where they think, well, that's how black people are. So I think that on the one hand, we have to recognize that audiences decode images differently based on their location within a group. But I think the other thing that's important to note is that stereotypes aren't always or inherently negative or, mendacious or mean. They are heroic stereotypes. And the problem we get into, what we see so often with black stereotypes, is that we don't get the heroic stereotypes that we see in some of the other communities. And so it becomes a problem for not only black actors, but also black filmmakers who, like black actors, have to deal with the burden of representation, you know?
Well, let me just jump in, because there's the question of the positive and negative stereotypes, mm-hmm. but then there's also a question of, you know, can you use the master's tools to tear down the master's house?
Ooh.
And there are some black actors and filmmakers who've tried to combat stereotypes by using satire. Let's hear a clip from Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle.
I don't know why we leaving master's house. He been good to us. He feed us on Saturday, clothes us on Sunday, and then beat us on Monday. Or was it Tuesday? I don't know.
And cut.
Hi, my name is Robert Taylor, and I'm a black actor. I had to learn to play these slave parts. And now you can, too, at Hollywood's first black acting school. Let's talk to a graduate. This is Ricky Taylor. Ricky graduated from my class 3 years ago. Ricky, can you tell us what you've been doing since you've graduated?
Well, Robert, I've played 9 crooks, 4 gang leaders, 2 dope dealers. I played a rapist twice.
Whoa.
That was fun.
Now, that movie clearly did a lot to bring out the frustrations. I mean, is that kind of satire effective at bubbling up these larger issues?
I think so. I mean, I think on the one hand, they do point fun at the absurdity of stereotypes, but they also kind of indict Hollywood for its limited vision of what black actors can be. And so you get, you know, confronted with the idea of overt and covert stereotypes. But what I think is effective about that piece is not only is it a black actor, you know, commenting on, you know, the reality of what it means to work in Hollywood, but it also allows him to kind of show the range of black folks' a desire and eagerness to break through, as well as to show the levels of critique that black filmmakers have. I wanted to make another point, too, about the burden of representation and the role that something like Hollywood Shuffle does, is that, I mean, I think it points to the fact that black people understand the stages of their evolution in the industry. So, for example, Sidney Poitier makes, you know, someone like Will Smith possible today, right?
Yes. We're going to have to wrap up, but I want to thank you very much for leading us through a interesting discussion of how African-American lives are portrayed on the screen.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Anna Everett is professor and chair of film and media studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. To continue our conversation, we're now joined by director Bill Duke. Bill Duke's career is as diverse as it is long. The 6'4" Renaissance man has directed films including A Rage in Harlem, plus a recent project for PBS. He's also been in music videos for Busta Rhymes and played the recently converted black Muslim Abdullah in the film Car Wash. Bill, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you have had quite a career and continue to. We'll talk a little bit more about some of your upcoming projects. But on this issue of stereotyping, do African-American actors feel a responsibility to break stereotypes? And how does that affect the bottom line? I mean, you know, there's so many questions about what roles you really can get if you're an actor.
I think not only black actors, but all actors are always confronted between the choice of rendering it to Caesar, that which is Caesar's, and the God, that which is God's, you got to pay the bills. And at the same time, you want to make sure that you're as true to your craft and your values as possible. For black actors, the opportunities are very limited for women and men. And so in terms of making choices, if you're offered a role, there's always that dilemma. And you try to make the best choice you can based upon, you know, what your situation is financially and also what your situation is in terms of who you are as a person.
Now, you are someone who has a very imposing presence. There are people, everybody looks different, sounds different, but people get cast in types, you know, the light-skinned lady or the, you know, tall, imposing black man. When you think about your type as someone who is tall, who has physical heft, who has a very dramatic face, what did that do to you as an actor, pro and con?
Well, it usually made me a bad guy. I'm not a person that smiles a lot. I mean, I have a great sense of humor, and I laugh at jokes that are funny, but I don't laugh at jokes that are not funny. And I think that sometimes that's seen as threatening.
So let's talk about how people react to performances. There has been a lot of criticism of any number of African Americans for taking any number of acting jobs. I'm thinking in one way of Halle Berry in Monsters Ball. How could you take that role? That's not good for the black community. And you can extrapolate that to many different instances. Should actors be judged on the basis of roles they take? Is that fair?
That's a very, very good question. Is it fair? No. Is it something that we must take into consideration? Yes. Because we don't have the same opportunities or the same breadth of roles that others have. I mean, the roles just are not there. So people are doing the best many times with what they are given. And so, yes, I think people who are outside the industry can be judgmental and say, well, you shouldn't have taken that role because, you know, he got killed or you had sex with somebody or whatever it is. But, you know, what you're really asking people to do is to get out of the business to a certain extent because those are the things they're offered. But there's also hypocrisy. When people are given films that are wonderful, you know, sometimes black people, the great debaters, people didn't show up. There was no strange sex or anything in that, but black folks didn't come to the box office. Why? If they don't want, you know, Halle Berry to do something sexual in the film, and they're saying, okay, do something that's, you know, moral, etc., then support it. But there's a lot of hypocrisy in the black community because they want to go to heaven, but they don't want to die.
What about flipping the side of the lens that you're on? You're someone who has been very strategic in doing projects for television, projects for film as a director. What does it do when you, as someone who has creative control, takes a look at what options you can offer the actors? How do you then present what you want as a director to the people you're working with?
Well, you know, for me, acting is a sacred art, you know. It's like, I don't think people really understand, you know, everybody thinks they can do it. And the truth of the matter is it's a real sacred craft. It takes a lot of courage. I mean, you have to really be a person who really is willing to be fearless. And so when I choose an actor or work with an actor, I try to let that person know that they're in a safe environment, they're totally supported, I know the journey they have to go through to get to the essence of this character, etc. So I try my best as an actor to understand what actors who are really going to do it go through and give them as much support as I possibly can.
Tell us just briefly about a couple of the things that you've got coming up.
Well, three things. One, I just finished a documentary called The Faces of HIV, which documents the peril of us as a culture in terms of the AIDS pandemic. One out of seven men in D.C. is infected. Out of all the reported cases of AIDS with women in this nation, 70% are black women. And 85% of those women are infected by men who know they have the disease. And when I did this research, I really felt that, you know, the community should know about it. And so there's a documentary called The Faces of HIV, which is coming out very soon. Also, a feature film being released February 22nd in theaters called Cover, C-O-V-E-R. And it's a murder mystery, but it also deals with AIDS in our community, et cetera. Then later on in the year, I directed a film for Sony Screen Gems called Nightly Broken for Bishop T.D. Jakes. And that comes out later this year. So it's been a good year. And luckily, I've been able to, in my films, talk about things that are meaningful to me because that's the way I want to use the rest of my career.
Well, Bill, thanks so much.
God bless you, and thank you so much for your support.
Bill Duke is an acclaimed actor and filmmaker. He currently has his hands in several works, and he spoke with me from his home in Los Angeles. We'll be right back.
Next on News and Notes, the New York Giants can still taste sweet Super Bowl victory. That's on our Sports Bloggers Roundtable. Plus, we read from your letters. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's Thursday, and that means sports is back on the table. And here to drive that subject, as always, is our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, it's been a pretty dramatic week for pro football and basketball fans. So here to help us sort through the aftermath of Super Sunday's big game and a couple of blockbuster trades in the NBA is Greg Lee. He is the online editor for the Boston Globe. Out of New York, we have Justin Grant. Justin writes for AlphaBlogSports.com. And Jamel Hill is in Florida. She writes for ESPN.com. Hey, everybody.
Hey, how you doing?
Let's start with this. In the tri-state area, Justin, everywhere a member of the New York Giants shows up in public, people stand and cheer. They're loving this. These guys will never have to buy another drink, will they?
Well, I don't know about that, Tony. People have short memories around here. This is a pretty tough place to win. And I guarantee you next year, if Eli has another four-interception game like he did against the Minnesota Vikings in November, they'll be calling for his head again.
That's the exact question, as a matter of fact, Jamel, I was going to put to you about where does he stand, because he did have that great big play in the fourth quarter that led to the, let's call it the helmet catch by David Tyree, the wide receiver, and he won the game's MVP award. But, you know, some of his teammates did throw him under the bus this year. Like Justin said, if he doesn't do well, will they throw him under the bus again next year?
No, I don't think so. I mean, at least it won't. I think he'd have to play pretty poorly for that to happen. But I think Eli has kind of turned the corner. He got a huge monkey off his back, if you will, because I think he needed the confidence to be able to sort of prove to himself that he could play at the level that he played at in the playoffs. And I think he's sort of learned how not to make mistakes. I mean, I'm not sure if he is as talented as his brother in terms of being a pure thrower, but I think he's got some guts, and I think he'll play a lot differently during the regular season than he did this year.
So, Greg, let's go up the coast a little bit to you. Talk about a rivalry. I guess it's officially grown now, New York versus Boston in baseball, now in football. Let's forget about basketball. That's not going to happen. But here's the question. New England fans have had a few days to digest the loss. How are the folks handling it up there, and just how big an upset do the New Englanders think this was?
Well, Tony, I remember I was watching the game with a friend, and there was a lot of New England fans in downstairs in this big hall watching the game. And there was a lot of noise, hoopla, and what have you. And after the game, it was just stone silence, crickets. It was just very stunned that everyone thought the Patriots had this game in the bag. It was just a matter of time for the Patriots to have the coronation, get ready for the fourth parade. It was just stunned. It was just shocked to see that Tom Brady's offense could not muster up more than 14 points, and that was just a shocker that the team didn't adjust to what the Giants were doing to them.
Let me follow up with this. What about Spygate? Of course, we're talking about the accusations that the Patriots stole signals and videotaped practices of opposing teams going all the way back to 2002 when they beat the Rams in the Super Bowl. Congress is getting into the act now, Greg, with Senator Arlen Specter looking for answers. What do you think is going to come of this?
Well, I think Roger Goodell is going to try to, he's going to talk to the former video photographer Matt Walsh, who is in Hawaii right now working as a club pro, to try to get testimony from him about what his involvement was with the Patriots back in 2001 with regards to that Rams investigation. I think Roger Goodell is going to cooperate with Congress and try to figure out what really went down with Spygate. I think the whole Spygate thing really wore down on the Patriots. I think just the whole, not only to try to pursue perfection, I think Spygate, Rodney Harrison, remember, had the HGA suspension early in the year. I think a lot of things, just a culmination. I think the team was just worn down mentally, and I think that showed on the last month of the season for the Patriots.
Hey, Justin,
let me just say that I think that Congress involvement in Spygate is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my professional sports.
And why do you say that?
I think it's stupid, because what has that got to do with anything going on in this country? I mean, steroids I can understand, but you mean to tell me that Arlen Specter is so He's so greedy for some headlines that he's going to look into whether or not a team is stealing signals. I mean, that's just dumb. I mean, the next thing you know, they're going to be looking into what kind of playbooks people are using. How could the American people possibly benefit from Congress being involved in this?
Well, I
don't understand, like, why, you know, everybody steals signals to some degree in football.
And part of sports.
In all sports, really. I mean, Greg is absolutely right. And so I just don't understand what this has to do with anything. And if I'm Matt Walsh, I wouldn't even talk to these people. For what? Roger Goodell has no subpoena power.
Isn't sports big business? And when you have big business and how one franchise can win over another, there's millions of dollars at stake. Isn't that reason enough to look into it?
But this is not – it's not like – this is some epidemic. It's not like it has any impact on the youth. This has nothing to do with anything in our everyday lives. I mean, no. Armand Spector has nothing else to do with his time to worry about whether Bill Belichick is still a signal. What, did he have money on the game in 99? Is that what happened? I mean, it just boggles my mind that a senator with his credentials would even care about this. And it's a huge abuse of power, in my opinion.
All right, let's move on to one more topic about the Super Bowl before we move on to talk about the NBA. The Giants, Justin, are not favored to repeat, according to the odds makers in Las Vegas. It's not even close at the moment. And in fact, the Patriots are said to have a better chance next year with or without Randy Moss, who may or may not return to New England. You buying any of that?
I'm not too sure about that. This is a copycat league. The Giants and I think the Baltimore Ravens this year showed, or they gave the blueprint on how to slow this team down. Pester Tom Brady, get in his face, knock him down a little bit, prevent the team from going over the top downfield, try to limit this team to the underneath stuff and prevent the big play. I'm not too sure that I would bet on the Patriots duplicating what they did this year, next year, at least advancing to the Super Bowl. And I definitely don't believe they'll win their first 18 games or threaten to have the perfect record.
All right, bye-bye NFL. Hello, NBA. The season is really moving along at college and pro, actually, in basketball. But the NBA is the focus this week, with apologies, of course, to North Carolina and Duke fans after their game last night. But the trade winds blew from L.A. to Memphis and from Miami back to Phoenix. 7-foot All-Star Paul Gasol was shipped from the Grizz to the Lakers, which the whole league is calling a steal. Now Shaq has been sent from the Heat to the Suns in what the league is calling, well, what is the league saying about that, Jamel?
Well, I think people are very curious to see how the Shaq experiment works out, just because based off what we've seen from him probably the last couple seasons, he seems to be a player in serious decline. The Phoenix is a team that likes to run and gun quite a bit, and so I think people are wondering whether or not his kind of plotting style can fit in with what the Phoenix Suns do. And I'm wondering myself. However, I think people are maybe overestimating Shaq's demise a little bit. I think he will be able to help that team as long as he goes there, plays defense, rebounds, and really it's just a question of health, because I think Phoenix sort of is looking at the landscape in the West and thinking, well, you know, we've tried to outscore people by winning. Maybe it's time that we have more of a half-court approach. So if he's healthy, I think he can definitely help them. Nevertheless, I still think the Lakers probably made the smarter move by getting Paul Gasol.
What do you say about the Gasol move, Justin?
Well, the Gasol move definitely puts the Lakers, I think, in the driver's seat towards getting out of the West. I would call them the team to beat. And when looking at the Phoenix Suns trade, I think this is a knee-jerk reaction by Suns GM Steve Kerr. Clearly, he was looking at the front line that the Lakers were going to come with the 6'10" Lamar Odom, the 7-foot Paul Gasol, and if he returns, the 7-foot-plus Andrew Bynum. So I definitely think there was some concern on his part. And also, I think Jamel alluded to this, if Shaq can stay healthy, this is the big key here. If Shaq can stay healthy, I can envision him grabbing rebounds on a defensive end, kickstarting the break, and perhaps even benefiting the team with his passing abilities out of the half-court sets. But the big question here is going to be, how healthy is he? He's already missed 14 games this year with a hip problem.
And he's perhaps out right
Steve
now, too.
Perhaps Steve Kerr knows something that none of us know, but this really is a head-scratcher for me.
Greg Lee, the Celtics are the favorites in the East to make it to the championship this year, Detroit notwithstanding. But with Garnett sidelined, lately they haven't looked so unbeatable. Just ask Cleveland, who dropped them the other night in triple overtime. Do you see a return of the Celtics-Lakers rivalry for the NBA crown this year? Do you realize it's been almost 20 years since Bird and Magic did their thing against each other?
If they do meet up, can they wear short shorts like back in the day? Real good flashback.
Please don't do that. Please don't do that.
I don't know if anybody wants to see that.
I don't want to see that.
No, but really, last week the Celtics showed me, without Kevin Garnett, beating the Dallas Mavericks at home, showed me that I think they can make it through the East. I still think Detroit will be a formidable opponent, and it'll be a great seven-game series. So I'm definitely not counting out Detroit. I think it's Detroit and Boston. But if Kevin Garnett stays healthy, and I still believe the Celtics still need to get a backup point guard to help out Rondo for the veteran point guard leadership in a tight game when they need someone, and they may try to get Sam Cassell. They need someone down the stretch to really help the team, get to that next level and to guard people like Chauncey Billups, and try to stop him down the stretch. As we know, Chauncey Billups, Mr. Big Shot, in the fourth quarter when the game's online, he's going to get the ball and he's going to take care of the Pistons. So the Celtics need something to counter that.
All right, last topic. You want to say something, Jermaine?
If anything, I think Kevin Garnett, him being out and seeing how the Celtics has struggled, it probably improves his MVP chances, because I think you see what that team is like when he's not there.
I don't think he wants that. He wants a ring. Don't you think? He wants a ring. All right, last topic is this, in the few moments that we do have. This was a big sports week, obviously, but it was also a big week in politics. And I bring that up because politics is the one area where you rarely see athletes involved, publicly at least, black athletes. This primary season, we have had a couple of sports legends give endorsements: Magic Johnson for Hillary Clinton, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar for Barack Obama. But unless I've missed it, no other high-profile athletes are putting their names and influence out there, politically speaking. Justin, with you first. Why is that?
Well, I think they've probably taken cues from what Michael Jordan did back in 1990. If you remember, Harvey Gantt, a black candidate, was running for a Senate seat against a former segregationist he's running against, and Michael Jordan refused to endorse him. He famously remarked, "Republicans buy sneakers too." So I definitely think it's, these athletes have corporate interests, and they do not want to jeopardize that by endorsing a candidate and perhaps alienating some of their constituencies. Also, last year, Ira Noble of the Cavaliers drafted an open letter to the Chinese government condemning them for their role in the ongoing genocide in Darfur. Now, everybody on that team signed that letter except for Damon Jones and LeBron James.
That's
and
right.
Remember, LeBron has a $90 million deal with Nike, who has huge business interests in China. So, this is the world we live in.
I think it's kind of sad, personally, because, I think athletes, at the very least, should be involved in the political process to encourage young folks to vote. And to me, it really says something, I think, very condemning about their interests, about where their hearts lie by not getting involved. Because at the very least, they should be encouraging people to vote. They don't have to encourage them to vote Republican. They don't have to encourage them to vote Democrat, but encourage them to be a part of the political process. And it's really sad, because you see that money has desensitized them from speaking up. And, If LeBron James came out and endorsed Barack Obama, nothing would happen to him. Nothing at all.
It'd be fashionable to vote for Obama.
Yeah,
it's amazing that nothing has happened. I don't know if that is going to change, but it's a topic I think that it's worth revisiting. You agree that we should talk about this again?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I wouldn't just blame black athletes. I don't see athletes of any race really coming out and endorsing candidates. In fact, the only current athlete I can remember recently to endorse a candidate was Curt Schilling endorsing President Bush in 2004. So I can't really just put the onus on black athletes.
It's not just on the black athletes.
Yeah, I can't do that.
I'll take that. Greg Lee is online editor for the Boston Globe. Jermaine Hill writing for ESPN.com. And Justin Grant blogs for AlphaBlogSports.com. Everybody, thank you very much.
That was NPR's Tony Cox.
And now it's time for your letters. Joining me to sort through the mail is our producer and editor, Christopher Johnson. Hey, what have we got today?
Well, you remember last week's story we did on Briggs v. Elliott, right? That's the South Carolina desegregation case that eventually became part of Brown versus Board of Education. And you interviewed three men whose families were directly involved in Briggs. One of them was Joseph DeLane Jr. He's the son of the late Reverend Joseph DeLane. Now, Reverend DeLane helped black parents in Summerton County bring their suit to court. Here's Joseph Jr. remembering his father.
He was involved in activities outside of his church parish as much as he was in the church parish. So therefore, he had the confidence of people there, particularly the African Americans. And he was very involved or concerned about their socioeconomic problems in that area.
Listener William Durant in Jonesboro, Georgia, called us on an important omission in that conversation. You did not mention that Reverend DeLane and his family suffered cruel repercussions. He lived in exile for the rest of his life, fighting extradition attempts and possible arrest for having had the audacity to fire back in self-defense the night he was forced to leave Summerton in 1955. This was after racist whites had burned his church, threatened his life, and committed other acts of terrorism and harassment over the years. Christopher, we also got this letter from Judy Riley in Monterey, California. Judy writes, I listen to News and Notes because I really enjoy hearing points of view that I can't hear anywhere else. I don't know why you feel it necessary to bring so many mainstream right-wing guests to your show. We can hear these points of view anytime we want, simply by turning on Fox News. The public airways are full of right-wing Republican blah blah. I turn you on to hear something fresh, interesting, and intelligent. I love News and Notes the way you were. Please don't go fair and balanced on me. Well, Judy, we have to add you to the mashup with the people who tell us we don't have enough Republican or conservative voices on the air. Hey, we just make the radio. We report. You're the decider.
And last week, News and Notes started a month-long series about blacks and black images in film. Farai, you spoke with two guests about some of the different ways that blacks have been portrayed on the big screen. Pat Jones in Louisiana heard that interview. She sent us this note. I was very disappointed today. Your two movie expert guests both use the same stereotyping of whites that we rightly condemn when it's directed at African Americans. Their negative remarks about To Kill a Mockingbird implied that all white people who saw it identified with the villains. In the future, please try not to have two guests at the same time who both obviously find it hard to imagine that decent, colorblind people could possibly live in white skins.
And finally, just a touch of love, and we do love the love, is from Femina Ajayi in Minneapolis. She wrote us to say, I really enjoy listening to your show every day in my office. The subject matter is something I can relate to as a biracial woman. Way to go, and thank you.
That's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. And as always, thanks, Christopher.
You're welcome, Farai.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the White House race continues with the primary and more caucuses this weekend. We'll weigh in on the contenders.
Keep me high, baby, just a little bit. Just a little bit.